This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jenny hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
In the beginning, we had the top down, wind in our hairpins. We buckled up and buckled down, head through the tailspins. With no security, just adventure, with the will to survive. Hugging the curves with the pedal down. Stay alive, cause history is never made. History is never made. History is never made. History is never made in a straight line.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you from the cozy confines of Trinidad World Recording Studios, my studio here in Fort Worth, where we talk all things P2, all things music, all over the world, all over the map, to fans listening worldwide on philpritchett.com and on radiofreetexas.org. Guiding you in these chaotic music times through the fog, through the water, bringing you into the bay and showing you the lighthouse on the shore. Well, folks, it's a special day today because we have a special guest here with us today. You will know him as big Phil Pritchett and the Full Band fans, as the author of Snuff Machine. Yes, that's correct. But he is that. He is that and so much more.
Oh, God, I hope so.
My good friend, my best friend. The case could be well made.
Yes, it could.
Since the seventh grade, my good friend who I started my whole musical journey with in middle school through high school, college, and continuing to this day, he is Wes Cunningham.
Delighted.
Welcome to the show,
delighted.
Cunningham.
So happy.
Well, he's been
to be here.
He's been picking up on the P2 Podcast here. Of course, we've always kept up through the years. Both have taken just so many different musical journeys. But it all started for us. I don't know if we should maybe bring people up to speed on kind of our history a little bit. And then in the second segment, talk a little more about what you're doing today. Wes is a songwriter. He's always done music.
Yeah.
Always done music forever. Mm-hmm. And he was on Warner Brothers Records. So many stories there. Lived in Nashville forever. A lot of the fans know I moved to Nashville. You left Nashville pretty much when I got there.
Yeah.
Moved to Chicago.
Ships in the night.
Ships in the night, really. So Cunningham moved to Chicago, L.A. He's seen a lot, done a lot.
Yeah.
You once had Beck's phone number.
Said to heck with it.
Once had Beck's phone. Go on, give me another little tidbit. Once sat next to Toby Keith on a plane. No, what's something else? I don't know.
Dang, that's a good, yeah.
Backstage with Dave Matthews, wasn't that one?
Yeah, that was one, uh-huh. Backstage with Dave Matthews is a good one.
Of course, you introduced me to the great, what's the guy's name, Richard? We told the story about, who's the engineer? Richard Dodd.
The great Richard Dodd,
We did a show about Petty and the Traveling Wilburys, mm-hmm. and talked about how Richard Dodd, and I said, well, I got to meet Richard Dodd at one of Wes Cunningham's recording sessions in Nashville.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where he told the story about he got to go, hey man, turn up the bass, and Dodd just goes like that, and he just kind of cranked it up. And everybody was just mortified. Like, you don't tell Richard Dodd how to mix a song. My poor friend Wes was like, oh, I didn't know that. I just thought I'd turn the bass up a little bit.
Oh, God.
So many lessons learned. Well, how have you been? Tell us what you're doing now. You live in Waco, Texas.
Well, shouldn't we go back to when we were seventh grade? Or we'll come back to that.
Man, listen.
Anyway, this is your show.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that. Okay. I think our second segment, maybe. So what are you doing these days?
Exciting.
You're writing songs.
I'm writing songs.
As you always have.
Well, kind of know, you know? I got married and moved to Los Angeles for about a year, and that pretty much took it all out of me. So then we moved back to Texas, and I decided to go legit and for the first time tried to find a job.
Yes.
And that began a 4 or 5 years of the guitar going under the bed.
Right.
So no, this is kind of a new deal. We could talk about the missing years.
Right, right. A lot of missing years.
I was most happy.
But
I think what our
listeners out there will be interested to hear is Wes has had a tremendous experience. I mean,
it was just
we came out of college, you and I. I kind of started banging around in the Texas music world.
Right.
And then Wes had some friends of his from went to Baylor and Waco. Guys who were connected in Nashville a bit, maybe moving up there. Hey, you ought to get up here with your music. And, man, Wes went up there and just had a kind of a whirlwind of experience there, I think it's fair to say. Signing with Warner Brothers, making a couple of records for them, playing showcases throughout. A lot of highs and lows throughout that whole thing.
Totally.
And a lot of lessons. I think it's very mysterious for a lot of guys who come in here and record and guys who maybe never left Texas or have never been to Nashville and really been in a lot of the inner workings to know kind of, you know, to get some skinny, some experience, some firsthand knowledge on how some of that stuff works and how it affects as a real Texas guy who's kind of been out there moving around. So when did that all, I mean, you were in college. Wes and I played in middle school, high school, really serious. We took ourselves very seriously in high school, it's fair to say.
Some more than others, but yeah.
Some more than others.
I was always the bleeding artist.
Uh-huh. Wes was the bleeding artist. I was the guy who was a golfer but could also play bass.
And not entirely true, but those were the roles.
That's somewhat true.
Well, you know, it's hard to distill the bits that may be interesting or not.
Yeah.
Going to Nashville, you know, I kicked around there for a couple of years and just tried to play little shows and tried to make little recordings where I could. But ultimately, I found this a sympathetic ear at a jingle company. And
Chris Parker at Whistler's Music.
Uh-huh. We started making songs. We made about 8 songs hours over there.
Fans will know that from Phil Pritchett's Suburban Legends album was recorded there. But Wes had already been well ingrained and doctrined in that whole, you know, in that studio, the old place and the new place they had there.
Right.
Chris Parker.
It was a different time. It's just, what's so fascinating is this was 10 years ago. And what's so amazing is how, when looking back on it now, it just seems like it's some sort of, you know, Beatles documentary. The way technology has changed everything.
Yeah, yeah. And,
you know,
and the way the business has
just
changed.
Just like we were talking about earlier, it's like, you know, what do? You go, you make music, and you hope an A&R guy comes and listens to your record and or sees you play. And
you got something,
sign
kid.
These boys up.
Yeah.
And then the record company stands by you, and they put out 2 or 3 records until people finally start to get a feeling of who you are as an artist.
Right, right.
That's sort of what you're thinking is the process.
Cause demanding.
Those are the bios we read when we were growing
up.
And you saw John Cougar, and you saw Petty, you know, and, of course, Beatles, you know. But
sure.
That's how it happens.
Demanding sushi and string sections. And
honoring your artistic whims, and you're an artist, you know. So
that's right.
It's very... What's so fascinating is, for me, thinking of how I acted back then. I wrote music, we recorded it, sounded great, and we kind of just passed it around, and a few record companies liked it.
Right.
And they happened to be...
This was what, 99,
98? 98.
Somewhere in there, yeah, I remember that.
And so suddenly, which was just unbelievable to me... I have zero. I haven't had money for a couple of years, and I'm fine with that. I'm really good with it.
You're out of college.
I mean, like $14 is how much money I have.
You're living on beans and tortillas.
I spent 10 of it on coffee.
That's right.
4 of it on Nat Sherman cigarettes.
That's right.
So the next thing I know, they're saying, Jive in New York.
Loves it.
They're coming out with this new artist called Britney Spears. You never heard of her, but you will. And, you know,
yeah, right.
Things we get, yeah, right. I'm gonna hear, but you know. And so they're flying you up. Richard Branson wants to fly you over. I mean, that kind of stuff. It's not because of the great. I had something to do with the music. The music was good. The music that we made in that time was really good. But it had something, it had everything to do with the industry at the time. One, if a big record company like Warner's had it in L.A. and they liked it, well, then suddenly it was good enough for everyone else to like.
Right.
And that validated it. And next thing you know, we have a bidding war going on, and it's insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just insane. So I'm getting flown around. I decided to go with Warner's because I think mainly because Tom Petty was on Warner's.
That's right.
And Costello was there.
And R.E.M.
R.E.M. And yeah. I just thought it sounded...
Well, it sounded
legit.
The biggest American company, yeah.
My heart liked Jive.
Yeah, is that right?
Because I love New York, and I love that idea of big... But they had this teeny bopper girl named Britney Spears, you know, and
I
don't know. That doesn't seem...
This isn't going anywhere.
I'm going to do anything.
Well, yeah, so...
And plus, Jive had this whole idea was they were going to kind of refashion some of my music to make it more palatable and pop.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I was reading my John Lennon bios, and I was like, screw you.
We're cutting the analog tape.
Yeah, no, right. I'm an artist. You will not mess with my music.
That's right.
And the audacity of the – and so clearly –
And make no mistake, during this time, some of these demos and things, Phil Pritchett, your own host here, reveled in trips to Nashville. Wes was always more always let me sleep on the couch, of course, and rock out and squeeze me onto a session, you know, playing bass on a song or something.
Yeah.
And man, it was, man, those were great. Those were some great days though, man. You were living in the house over there with the drummer. Were you living with Bobby Slacks?
Yeah.
Or was it, who else is in there? Was Maddie there?
No, it was just me and Slacks. Well, what was interesting was...
Had a great house.
When everyone tells you that when you get that instant ego, when all of a sudden...
You think you're great, and sure enough, everyone just goes, yes, you are great.
When you get that validation, however temporal and you know...
Initial it is, yeah.
I mean, it's not even real.
Right, right.
But when you perceive that validation, all of a sudden, it frees you up to think like a genius.
Yeah.
In other words, I start telling myself... I'm a friggin' genius.
Yeah, look, everyone's telling me.
So I start writing, so I start making music in that mindset, and guess actually the music is good.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you have that.
You're playing up to it.
That crazy confidence, exactly right. It's like if you were, I'm sure, if you were shooting hoops with, you know, with Jordan and some great players, you'll elevate your game a little. And
that's right.
That doesn't have much to do with what I'm saying.
No, I know what you're, so how did this all go down? Because, I mean, I was around for that. Like I said, I went to a lot of the sessions. I met Parker. I met Paul Evans, Rivers Rutherford, all these dudes that were hanging around. Bobby Slacks, the drummer, Graffinino, the guitar player. All these great – man, what was so cool for me was I was young, married, playing, living in Austin. But, man, it was just the business, man. Every building up there in downtown Nashville had a studio in the basement, you know, Music Row there. And you went out that night, and who'd you see in the bars? You saw other musicians, songwriters, everybody, you know, bitching about, I can't get this thing cut, or we're working on this thing, and casually mentioning that, you know, John Cougar was in town, you know, what an asshole. Or, I mean, it's just all these people you've read about your whole life, or they're just part of the fabric all of a sudden. It was very exciting, and you know, and I was just like, I go, man, I can't believe my friend Cunningham is, he's one of these guys, you know?
Instant access.
You know, it is. It really is.
Exactly right.
It was an intoxicating time, really, for me. I'm just talking about from an outsider kind of visiting and hanging out. So how did the whole thing go down with I mean, did Warner Brothers, did they send you a acceptance letter? Or how does that work?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's like, it's hard to explain. It's like when you get the part. It's like you audition for the part in the play, and you get it.
They're waiting until next week, but to hear back from this guy, and you're holding your breath.
And then now what? Yeah. The point here's what I'm trying to say. So Warner's signs me. So I sign with Warner's for a two record deal and a video.
Mm-hmm. Warner Brothers Records,
and then. It's almost like the brakes started tapping immediately after I sign, because it's almost like, well, they got Warner's got him, and right about that time Warner's was going through a whole change, and they've got a new president and new A&R people,
and
it was all turning over. And keep in mind, this is when Napster was hitting,
on scene. 2000, 99.
People were starting to share file, you know, this whole like, what's going to happen to music, the future of music.
Yeah.
And I was sort of the last one signed under that old school guard, which is
to get the big advance,
give the artist
the big
advance, and give him a ton of money to go make his record at a proper recording studio.
Yeah, right.
And so
yeah, it's very, very old world, just like they would have done in the 70s. Yeah, yeah.
So what happened next was, you know, not much. I mean, I got on what they did.
And they essentially just released the record y'all had already made in Nashville.
Yeah, I added a few songs. Right. I went back in studio and added a few songs. And then they put the record out. And I toured a little bit. I played with some fun people. I got to play with
Chris Isaac. You did some shows.
Chris Isaac.
Played at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville.
Yeah, that was a
memorable
dream.
Night. Totally. Hell yeah.
That's a whole nother, that's like an hour long show playing at the Ryman.
Right.
Buddy Guy, some legends.
Yeah, I
got to open for Wilco a few times and hang out with those guys. And so we had some really fun shows. And but for the most part, the industry, and I don't want to blame this on the industry by any means, but I'm just saying that things were in flux and there was never really an attention given to putting that record out. And so it went largely unnoticed. There were a few markets, which is a funny, you know, like a couple of markets
where you get a lot of radio play.
Yeah, I got a lot of radio play.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd
yeah.
show up and I'd play and there would be people there singing along and that was a trip. You know, we played once for, you know, 10,000 people. It was an outdoor festival, the 4th of July thing in San Francisco, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I played with Wilco then and it was just like one of those. I remember I got my camera out and then I sort of held it to me with the crowd behind me, just a sea of people, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was fortunate to recognize that moment as like, I mean, this is surreal. I mean, this is like out of a movie, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, so then that was it. I made the record, didn't do well because no one, it didn't get heard. So then I made a second record for Warner's because that was part of the contract. And that's a whole other story, which
we're going to get into that.
Yeah,
we've heard the rise of Wes Cunningham has now been documented for our listeners out there. And the whole time, P2 is out there lurking in the shadows, trying to. Here's Wes and his. Who are you? Dude, I'd get some weird looks from guys. Because you're a musician on a session, or you're a producer, and I'm Wes's friend. I'm just kind of standing in the back, like, yeah, man, that's a good sounding guitar or something. They kind of look over, like, you know, what does he know? You know.
Yeah.
So I tried to keep my mouth shut, you know, just be on the wall. More with my good friend Wes Cunningham, the trials and tribulations of the major label roller coaster ride. More of that when we come back.
The downside. Spiraling out of control.
When we come back.
Picture of you and me when we were younger. Still amazed how those days were numbered. Not making money, just history, one day at a time. We took the straight road to glory. But it started to wind, 'cause history is never made. History is never
fans, made. Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast. Did you know we got the new t-shirt out? It's got the Roman helmet on it. It says, fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Just in time for Christmas season. Check it out, philpritchard.com. Shoot me an email, phil@philpritchard.com. Say, Phil, we know you probably wouldn't want to play by our swimming pool, but we thought maybe we ask. Let me tell you what. Catch me on the right night, you might be surprised. It happens more than you realize. So call us. Book the band. We'll come play a show for you, or come record at Trinidad. If you're a doctor or something and you just play in a band for fun, come record with Phil. I'm your producer, I'm telling you, right now. We do it all. Call me, 817-733-5256. The great Wes Cunningham is here. My lifelong musical buddy. We got our start in the sixth grade. We just found each other's kindred musical spirits back then. Mm. We were both ridiculously into the Beatles, man.
Right, complete geeks.
Total geeks. In an era where everybody was listening to the Joshua Tree, as they well should have, and as we did too.
They were listening to Dawkins. You know, they were listening hair bands and
hair bands. Me and Cunningham decided
we had discerning tastes.
We started a band in high school called All in One, where we wore ties to look like the Beatles. That's now that right. I don't know who you are out there, but that takes a lot of balls.
I feel like we didn't get beat up.
We showed up for a battle of the bands at our high school, and everybody had spiky hair. Bands were covering REM, playing original, Soundgarden-type music, some of it.
It wasn't that cool, though. It was, you know, the studs and stuff. You know,
A little spiky, little so study.
Yeah.
And then here we come. The song's called Twist and Shout. We were freshmen in high school, jeans, ties, white shirts, the whole thing, and obsessed with the Beatles. And it just led us into a life of music, of riches and brokenness, dire consequences, and everything in between.
Look where we are now. It's just terrible. I wish that I'd never heard of the Beatles.
Oh, come on. I'm not kidding.
I wish that I had just, you know, studied accounting. And bought the, you know, no.
Then he wouldn't have had the ride. He wouldn't have. Well, we've been catching up with Cunningham, filling in some of our listeners. Some of these guys out here thinking they're going to get a label deal or something like that. I think what's interesting about Wes's whole story is that it did take place before a lot of realities that current guys deal with every day. Like, hey, man, putting our stuff on MySpace and iTunes, make a few bucks here and there, make a record for, you know, $3,000 and release it everywhere. Not a reality really back in the day there. So Wes has ridden the Warner Brothers roller coaster, been everywhere, playing with Chris Isaac and Wilco. Was there a point where you started saying, like, man, this is things aren't happening fast enough? Or was it the changeover at Warner Brothers? Some of the guys that signed you get fired? What kind of started happening to maybe feel like, hey, maybe the dream has an end or something?
Right, right. Good question. Now, I was just sort of languishing. It never, you know, we had a top 10 on the college.
Triple A college kind of thing.
And that was kind of neat. That was it. And so I busied myself thinking, I'm still a very important artist, and they haven't heard my magnum opus yet. They haven't heard what I can do.
That's right.
And so I set about insisting. Well, first I bought a motorcycle.
Yeah,
and then a Suburban.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Gosh, you're riding high.
Oh, dude.
Riding
and a cell phone. I bought a cell phone.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was
yeah.
back in, you know, 99.
Maybe an amp, a guitar. You got free guitars from somewhere.
I got free guitar. Epiphone gave me a guitar deal.
You got some deals. All kinds of fun stuff.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. Meanwhile, your buddy Phil is over in the corner, just thinking, I can't believe I'm witnessing this right here.
Well, I
thought like you did. I go, man, I always knew he was talented, but man, oh my God, now the world does.
Yeah.
Well, what's next? What's next? Well, you know? So I sat and waited. So what started to happen? I don't know. The first record, I got out there a little bit. I heard on the radio KGSR, the hip AAA station there in Austin, was playing it.
Yeah, they played it a lot.
And people knew it.
The song, So It Goes.
So It Goes.
Yeah.
Cheeky. You know, cheeky poppy.
I've never done a song like it before. It's just one of those. Maybe I should more.
but it got out there. It wasn't totally discouraging. It got out there. So you set about making the next record.
Okay, so
what started happening?
Right.
Did it at Treasure Isle in Nashville primarily.
Wow, good.
Wasn't that where it was? I remember that studio was badass. God.
Well, here's the thing. I had this producer who...
What was his name? Barlow.
I don't want to say his name.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to say his name. I hear he's a great guy now. And he was fine then.
Don't get me wrong.
I was just as arrogant and naive. And essentially, this guy and me decided we were going to make the most kick-ass record of all time.
Ever, yes.
So important.
Yeah.
It's going to be very important.
Now, this was the session I came up and
it's called The Most Outstanding Girls. I mean, that was the name of the record was Most Outstanding Girl.
And we went up there, and Wes invited me along. And was, hey, man, we're recording, man. Drop by the studio. So I just drove up there.
Rented the studio for 6 weeks.
Oh, my gosh. 6 weeks, rented out. This guy, the producer, had just crate after crate after crate of guitar. I mean, vintage guitars, as far as the eye can see, acoustic, electric. He'd do a bass part with a Rickenbacker bass. Then he'd go back and he'd get a Hofner bass. Then he'd say, "Man, go get the P bass, not the 62, yeah. get the 66."
Right. But you
know,
they
go back and forth, and I couldn't believe it. I go, "Look at the detail. This is insane. This is the most insane thing I've ever seen."
Well, we had the 63 and the 65, but
which one do you like
better? We didn't have the 64.
No, they had a.
So we're gonna go rent that one.
And then we'd break for lunch and spend 2 hours eating sushi. You know,
naturally. Yeah.
You know, and then you had to do the strings in London. Wasn't that right? And it went on, a very involved session, very expensive, I would imagine.
Well, that's the... Yes, we went to London to record strings for some reason.
because in Nashville, they don't quite sound the same.
They don't sound the same. But it had to be done.
Well, it had to be done.
We tried to get Abbey
right.
Road. It
yeah,
was booked. Right. So we went off Broadway and got Kensington.
Kensington Stead, yeah.
It was brilliant. I mean,
had Elton John recorded there, someone.
Yeah, well, yeah. All of them, sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So you finished the record.
So we finished the record. We got close to finishing. Richard Dodd, as you mentioned
Richard
earlier.
Richard Dodd mixing it, yeah. You told him to turn up the bass.
Well, I didn't say anything to Richard Dodd. In fact, I always thought like he was laughing at me. Every time I, you know, would make a suggestion, he'd kind of roll his eyes and look at his assistant, you know. And like, what's that? It's my record. Can I make a suggestion?
He was the first guy that told me George Harrison was dying, despite what the papers were saying.
Oh, my gosh.
I remember that. Well, you know, I said, "Well, I heard he's doing better." He goes, "No, he's not doing better. It's over. Yeah. I don't think it'll be long
like,
now.
I just talked to Pat. He's not doing well.
I just talked to Pat. He's not doing well. I don't think it'll be long while." I just went, "What?" I remember taking that knowledge away. And sure enough, our friend George, Uncle George, the Beatle.
Right.
The quiet, the silent Beatle. So you're making...
Here's the interesting thing.
You know.
Here's the excess, okay? I won't put the figure on it. It was a lot of money
that
they said, we're under contract for two records.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I tried to get out of it and give me the money or let me go to another label.
Yeah,
actually. I tried to go to another label and they said, no, we want you here. You're important to us.
Yeah.
Great. I made this record. It's very... it's not... I didn't have hit in mind, which... You know, I'm not going to say I'm this important artist about it. I mean, I certainly wanted a hit because I wanted to keep doing what I was doing.
But you're writing for yourself, not the market.
I was writing for myself. And I was
As all the greats do.
Well, I was... here we go. You know, they were telling me I'm great, so I'm going to act great, and I'm going to write about things that I think I need to write about.
Right.
Things that are important to me. Okay. Which is not very different than when I was writing songs in eighth grade. I still thought I was great writing about things that were important to me.
It got you to where you were now, you know.
Anyway,
stick with it.
The long story. The short story is I made the record. I sent it to him. You know, ba-da-da-da, ba.
Turn it in. Yeah.
What do you think? Waiting by the phone. Well, Wes, you don't have an A&R guy over there anymore. Your guy was fired. Here's a new guy. New guy gets on and says,
"Where's Kenny? Kenny loves me. Just
exactly.
Kenny's fired.
The guy that signed me to the label. Where'd he go? He's gone. He's in another label.
We've been bought out. Didn't you read the papers?
Yeah. So,
yeah,
well, who's my contact? Well, we don't really have a contact for you. What's your name
again? We'll get back to you next week.
I said, my name is Wes, and you just gave me thousands and thousands of dollars to fly to England to make this beautiful record.
Yeah, and I've been
hired a composer... to deal with woodwinds.
Food has been catered.
The actual cello player played on all the Beatles set. He was the lead cellist in Eleanor Rigby, and here he is playing on my really important record.
Right, right.
Okay, so take stock of this record. They didn't know what to make of it. It was, first of all, it was 18 songs. Half of it was like rock, like real, like heavy rock, and the other half was real lush, like orchestrated harmonies, Beach Boys. And so it was a juxtaposition that was conscious that way. I was really trying, you know, and here I am being an artist again, but I'm saying I'm trying to make, juxtapose the
this is going to be a great double album.
There's things happening in my personal life where I had a love affair and a hate affair going on. So I was trying to put them together, right?
Bring the world up to speed on what's going on in your life.
Thank you.
As all of us try to do.
Well, no one was blogging then, so you know.
No, that's right. We spoke through our music back then, you know.
Yeah, like then.
Not now.
So they heard the record and they said, "Don't hear a hit." The same old story. Oh well.
The A&R man said, "I don't hear a single."
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so that was it. That was basically it. They
didn't release it.
They didn't release it. They sat on it. As far as I know, they still own it.
So they shelved it. I mean, that was it. It never came out.
Again, I tried to say, "Look, you guys have spent so much money on this record. Let me at least take it to somebody else." That was actually right on the time Wilco did the same thing.
Yeah, right.
And they said no. And so they, that was it.
Yeah.
And that was just it. And so I walked away, and there's this record that no one's heard except my friends. And
I loved it, by the way.
Thanks, Phil. And I'm actually in the process of trying to get it revived and at least to get a little EP of it out there. But that's the story. And let me just finish all this by saying it left such a bitter taste in my mouth, and it did a trip on me. My ego did I had a rather psychic breakdown. Eventually, it took me a couple of years after the disappointment of that to settle in and to sort of say, I moved to LA, try to do anything with music that I could. I did a few little commercials. I got a song or two in a movie.
Yeah, right.
And that was all very well, but it was such a hustle at that point because it was all me trying to get my stuff heard. And there I was again, the eighth grader with music in my backpack saying, listen to me.
Listen to my tapes.
You don't have to buy one here. Just have one. Eventually, my wife, we got married and we started to have our first kid, and the kid was on the way, and I said, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
Screw it.
Yeah.
Moved back to Texas, guitar under the bed, literally for 4.5 years.
Yeah.
Until the last year.
Yeah.
So that's really, I'm arrested development when it comes to, music and stuff at this, because I literally said, I've got to find a way to be okay with myself and to do something other than,
to think of yourself as something other than, a genius, rock musician.
I'm just another dude, It took a while for me to realize that. I'm just one of many
here.
It's not all about
me. You wrote Snuff Machine, for crying out loud.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's the big self-important story.
That's a great story, though. It's a great story. We can all learn a lot from it, man. Well, you know what? For whatever it's worth, I was keeping tabs, of course. You and I stayed in touch all through those years.
I feel good saying it. It's a cathartic thing.
It's cathartic. That's why. You know what? A lot of people come to the couch and they a lot of them will just lay down. I get off the notepad and they just, I don't know what happened, Phil.
Supine.
That's right. In the supine position, just pouring it all out there. Well, as Wes so eloquently said earlier on, who's to blame for all this? Who's to blame for our lives now of, bouncing around, carrying around tapes in our backpack? No one except for the lads from Liverpool. How did we get so into the Beatles? I mean, Cunningham and I would watch documentaries about the Beatles and just weep with joy. I don't know what it was. It was just a stupid thing. Kind of looking back on it in a way, I can hardly even put my finger on it. What void in my life it had filled. Very difficult. We're going to talk about our Beatles obsession and what's the one Beatle record you should own and debate.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 2, 3.
Revolver. Revolver in the vault and we get back.
Hey, everybody. This is Wes Cunningham. All you people out there in Phil world, you're listening to Phil Pritchett on the P2 Podcast.
Let me tell you.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. We are so lucky today to be joined by my longtime musical kindred spirit, I guess you'd have to say. Wes Cunningham is here. How you doing, Cunningham?
Brilliant.
You know what? He was recording on his computer, had some trouble. Came up here to the Mac store today. I said, man, come over. We'll do the podcast. Yeah. We'll catch up everything.
Yeah.
Tell the viewers worldwide, all the listeners out there on philpritchett.com, right. RadioFreeTexas.org. One man's experience, one man's story in the major label merry-go-round. Huh? Outstanding stuff, man. Well, thanks for sharing all that.
Do they even have labels anymore?
I don't know. I've got one in there in the closet if you want to check it out.
Great. All I need is a barcode.
It's a telephone and it's a cell phone and a computer. Well, as it's been alluded to, and as annoys many of my friends, You know, in the Texas music world in which I currently, in which I landed, in which I was born into, of course we all talk about the greatness of, you know, Willie Nelson, Robert Earl Keane, Jerry Jeff Walker, the inspirations that inspired a generation of fraternity guys to open a beer and say, I can too. You know what I mean? Absolutely. And I was no different. That was me.
Tissues.
There was no, I know, you want a box of tissues? We get them out sometimes. So, but man, I always felt kind of weird in the Texas music. Anybody will know this by listening to a lot of my stuff. There was always something in there, a rock element, a poppy deal, harmonies, tambourines, a little just, whatever it was. And man, I'm telling you, my mom went to college in New York, and she was a little bit of a beatnik some way. Very conservative woman, but loved Joan Baez and all that kind of stuff. Went to the airport when the Beatles landed at John F. Kennedy
That's
Airport.
Right.
It wasn't called John F. Kennedy Airport. What was it called? Yeah, JFK. Mm-hmm. Did they already name it after he'd gotten shot? I guess so. The Beatles landed there. What was it? February. The year was 1964. We had a song about the Beatle landing.
Wow.
It was like February 8th, whatever it was, 1964. So mom was there. My mom was there. She followed him to the Plaza Hotel. She was a freshman in college, I think. And anyway, so she was always into the Beatles. And I remember as a kid thinking, wow, the Beatles, man. I don't know if it meant a lot to my my mother. She played the guitar and sang. I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. And so, you know, I kind of went through my heavy metal thing in fifth, sixth grade. By seventh grade, though, my parents had given me Sgt. Pepper. So my mom had Sgt. Pepper's Beatles album. And I was like, man, this is like Mozart or some just Frank Sinatra or something.
Wait, I didn't realize that. You had Peppers in seventh grade?
Yes. That was my first one. As I put it in there.
That's
and there's all this, at the beginning, there's all this, there's an orchestra tuning up, talk. I'm like, what is this? This is just, and then all of a sudden, you just, and all of a sudden, dude, Van Halen was just going to the back seat. I was like, whoa, it was 20 years ago today. Then Ringo comes on. What would you think if I sang out of tune? You know, so my whole mind was blown in the seventh, eighth grade by Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. There it is. And then, I can't remember how you and I got talking about the Beatles. When was that? Seventh grade?
I was reading that John Lennon's biography and Ray Coleman.
That's right.
Eighth grade, and I think I lent it to you, and then you bought your own, and
got
started.
Wes and I knew each other from sports. You know, we played football, but you know, I was like, oh yeah, Cunningham. I know him, and we had a class or two together,
right.
Ms. Fulmer's English class, and at some point started thinking of ourselves as some sort of.
Lennon
and McCartney deal. We just lived in this fantasy land all the way through high school. But it came to a head, really. We just listened to the Beatles and obsessed and read books and watched movies and anything we could get on the Beatles, man. Yeah. We were obsessed. Then in eighth grade, there was a Broadway review that was evidently very uncool to be a part of. So a lot of the kids who didn't play sports and didn't wear trendy clothing.
Didn't really fit in.
No. That was something for them to do, to be in the musical.
Let me take it from here.
So what do we do?
Well, you're a better story.
No, I can't remember. So I just remember that there was like a medley thing. They were going to do, what were some of the songs we did in that?
One singular sensation, every little step she takes.
It was show tunes, man.
It was one of those musicals that just did show tune after show tune.
Yeah, it was a medley. You know, it came on.
It was a medley. And seventh and eighth graders.
You had a song. You had a song. I had a song. I don't know. We remember. We could do the whole show. Make no mistake.
I was so impressed.
So me and Wes, we were the only male eighth graders. It could be anybody in middle school, sixth through eighth grade, I think, in this, or seventh and eighth grade.
Okay, can I just stop you right here?
Okay.
So I invited Phil to spend the
Help
night.
Help me out. Can I lay down on the couch? Give me the tissues.
Phil and I, this is incredible, all you P2 fans.
Oh, my gosh.
Eighth grade. Spending the night at my house is a whole nother deal. It's a whole nother story with the
brothers,
birds,
sisters,
and
kids,
and the little
dog,
kids, and the great nuts.
Story.
And you can only have so much, you know, soda.
Total cereal.
But anyway, so Phil's over at my house spending the night. He brings his guitar with him.
Because
I asked him to.
It should be said, Wes was a good musician. His mother had trained him to play the piano and the fiddle.
I had an electric keyboard, but guitar was like way.
You didn't have anything cool. I mean, no. you know.
Mom taught piano, so yeah, I could.
So all of a sudden, you invite this rebel, this guy who I'd been in a band. See, I'd been in a heavy metal parachute band.
With bandanas.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Tied around your leg.
So you invite this guy, Phil, over.
Phil. And Phil comes over, and he plays Panama on the on his red guitar, his Fender Squire. And I was so blown away. I gathered my whole family at my insistence, and Phil, no one wanted to do it.
I was mortified. Phil I was like, you're bringing in your family. He goes, Mom and Dad, sit down. Listen to this. Listen to this.
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that you played that, because I heard that on the radio. You probably, there was a Def Leppard or something.
But you could play Mozart pieces on the piano. You could play fiddle parts by Bach. How are you so impressed with a guy sitting there playing three chords? What impressed you so much?
It was that rock and roll poison.
Was it? Was it? It really was. It had something. I mean, I know.
Because yeah,
I never understood that. I go, man, he can read. Wes can read sheet music and play.
I can't read sheet music.
I don't know. Well, you kind of could, couldn't you? Yeah.
Anyway, so he plays this thing, and I really couldn't believe it. And that was an eighth. And from then on, I was like, we got to do a band. And I don't care. We're doing a band, and we started practicing.
But
you're talking about the when they did the musical review to audition. Phil and I sang "Love Me Do."
Yes.
And I had the tambourine. Phil had the harmonica, and we did
two part harmony.
Just,
yeah.
And apparently we charmed the teachers. We thought we were rock stars. Looking back, they thought we were just cute. You know.
Right. Right. But we said, man, is it okay if we sing together? And they looked at each other very puzzled, because every kid was getting up there just going, tomorrow, right. Just okay, next, you know. So me and Cunningham go bouncing up on the stage. I got my harmonica.
Yeah,
I just go, no, we just go into love me do. We just do the whole bit.
Yeah.
And, dude, we blew them away. We blew those ladies away.
Well, not only that, they sent us on a middle school tour. And so we got us out of class, and one teacher would chaperone, and she would go around to all our little teachers and knock on, I'm sorry to interrupt, Mrs. Johnson. These two performers would like to perform for your class. And so I have still, to this day, have this memory.
Oh, me too. That was a turning point in my life.
Of me and Phil performing for some, you know, algebra class, and sitting on the front row is none other than Angie Harmon.
Yes, the actress. Married Jason Sehorn of the Giants.
Yes, and of course she was gorgeous.
Law and Order.
Even in eighth grade.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think she had just moved to our school.
Yes, front row.
And I remember her in the front row.
First time she ever looked at us. First and the last. And there we were.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That had to be the moment, because I remember she looked at me. And she saw me.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, my God.
This works.
Just that was enough.
Yeah, that's right.
And so we got to do this again, Phil.
Yeah.
We got to
develop our act. That's right. So we kept going.
Angie Harmon was looking
at Harmon, man. We were just up all night talking about how awesome we were at that point. So we tried out. So we did this musical deal. And I remember being backstage at that musical in the dressing rooms and putting on the tux and looking at the lights and the stage and the curtains and going out and singing and just feeling like, hey, man. And I remember even being so bold. I was so cocky because I knew we'd really blown them away at the auditions.
Right.
You and me going up to them and trying to alter the story. Do you remember this? They were like... When we talk, we go to the head drama lady. Of course, she's just trying to get a bunch of eighth graders to sing a song together.
Yeah,
we're just going, Mrs. Jones, Phil, do you have a just... Yeah. Me and Wes had an idea about how to make this whole musical better. Yeah. They're like, what would that be? Just, well, we figured that, you know, at some point in the show, we could say, and while Broadway was going on...
Right.
Across the ocean. Dun, 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 dun. We come running out. See, we're the Beatles. Look, we've got the wigs on. She's just looking at us like we're crazy. Yeah, we got somebody pretending to play the drums and Ringo, and I'll be Paul, because I'm kind of the Paul guy. Wes will be John Lennon.
I call John.
And then we'll get some other guy to be George. It doesn't matter. He can just go there. And we'll do three or four songs. It'll be great. The lights, it'll just be like, you know, the Ed Sullivan. And she was just looking at me like I was insane.
Yeah.
And I just had my Beatles fantasy going off.
Right, she's right. You're just in Phil world.
Phil, can we just stick to it? Just sing the...
Mame.
You charm the husk right off of the corn. Mame. I'm just like, oh, all right. So we had to go make our Beatles fantasy happen by ourselves.
So we started
just obsessing over the Beatles, man. Yeah. Talking in British accents. God, we were obnoxious.
Still are.
We still talk to each other in British accents on the phone. Yeah. How you doing, man? Are you still playing this band? Just, I don't know. Oh, it just went on and on. Well, what was your first Beatles experience? Did you have the young Beatles?
What was fascinating is I actually didn't know that about you. I'm in second grade, and my cousin plays the Sergeant Pepper, and I distinctly remember it. It's just Peppers.
Yeah.
But you know, that was then, and then fast forward to fourth or fifth grade, and I started digesting my parents' records, and I started with early Beatles, and because it looked, you know, the least intimidating.
Right.
And then eventually worked my way up through. But initially, it was Peppers, and I have that memory of just the
mind
the weird
blowing, the horns and everything. Yeah, yeah.
So no, I mean, I didn't even know. I didn't know their names or anything, but I just I liked them.
What was so confusing is we had the cassette tapes of the Capitol releases, which had all different songs out of order, a little weird, like The Help would be the soundtrack, and it was all weird. It was hard to get.
Yeah, right. You had something new, I remember. Like,
yeah, like those were all American releases. So it wasn't until years later I kind of got a real solid fix for like the English releases, you know, and stuff. And man, over the years, people talk about it, a lot of people like to kind of the Beatles. I don't know, you know, I like the Stones or whatever. Of course, we all think they're crazy, but Revolver was 1966, just a turning point for the Beatles. I think there's no way anybody. What's on there, Cunningham?
Let's take a look.
Read them off. What's the first song on there?
Track one, Taxman.
1, 2, 3. 'Cause I'm a Taxman.
Which is interesting. It's really George's. First
writing, yeah.
Okay, we're gonna really geek. Are we gonna geek out here?
No. You're gonna yell one out.
To know where
and
we're
I'm gonna do a little imitation of each one.
All right.
You know,
Eleanor Rigby.
Eleanor Rigby.
E minor to C.
That's right.
You know,
picks up the rice in the church where her wedding is being.
You know, I jammed with the cellist.
The cellist. Yes, you did. Of course. So, you and the Beatles.
He was 80 something.
Yeah.
Hardly coherent. He actually told me a really funny story about John Lennon during that session.
What?
He said John got really mad at the orchestra. He's like, no, yeah, I'm playing it. I'm freaking A. And he's banging this note on the piano. And it's not A. He's actually banging G. You know, he's throwing a tantrum because they're not playing in the right key. And he's hitting the wrong key. So.
Yeah, that's great.
So all the orchestra people had their moment there, you know.
John may have had a respite in the toilet.
Yeah.
Exactly. In the water closet.
Oh, what happened?
What happened to you, mate?
And then which is one of my favorite all time. And this won't be broadcast in time, but I'm Only Sleeping.
Your new band's doing
my new band.
Well?
We're playing it
awesome.
Tomorrow.
Love
night.
That show.
I'm Only
Keeping alive all the world's going by my window. Taking my time. This is a great underrated Beatles song. I'm Only Sleeping.
Yeah.
What else?
Love You Too. And then
Georgia.
Here, There, and Everywhere. Lovely Paul song. Yellow Submarine. She said.
Oh, one of the greats. I know what it's like to be dead. So dangerous and rocking. Just great. From a dream state. What else we got? What's after?
We have Good Day Sunshine.
Great little puppy medley.
One of my favorites all time, And Your Bird Can Sing.
It really goes Paul John. Slow rock. Kind of the whole song, the whole way it's set up, really.
Yeah, I guess so.
Kind of goes back
it?
And forth. Yeah, a little bit.
Because then you have For No One. Which is Paul, and then Dr. Robert, which is John.
Dear my friend, I said you called Dr. Robert. That was one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, I know
too,
you
man.
Love that one. And then George comes in with a want to tell you
it is filled with things to say.
Got to get you into my life, which is about, as we know, the ganja.
Oh.
Paul wrote it. It was a love affair with marijuana.
Yeah, still doing it, you know.
Yeah, I'll end up a token. And then tomorrow...
I took a puff, you know, and I thought, yeah, all right. Like
and I thought, there's an idea.
I had to Ringo, and he just said, that's just wonderful. I laughed and laughed. It was just wonderful. And I had it at the George, and he said... I was at Eric Clapton's house, and he said, you know, have a smoke. You know.
Brilliant.
So many documentaries later, we can all
Brian
talk about...
And Brian Epstein came in and decided... Hop.
Yeah, boys. George Epstein, yeah. George Martin came in and said, now, boys, let's get back and play the record.
This funny business,
boys. And it ends with...
Tomorrow Never Knows, which is a... God.
Inspiration.
Wow.
Turn off your mind, relax,
I mean, that's
and float downstream. I used to fall asleep with the headphones on listening to this album. Mm-hmm. It would just blow my mind. I just went off to school, the 7th or 8th grade the next day, with my head swimming with those images from Peppers and... and a revolver, and just it just blew my freaking mind, man.
What was interesting is that these are Beatles. They've made their name playing "I Want to Hold Your Hand."
Yeah,
they could get away with just doing more fun poppy music.
La 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 la.
It's what's so remarkable, and one of many things is that, for example, like "And Your Bird Can Sing."
Yeah,
like they didn't have to do all that.
As I've often said, what if a song today on the radio is, hey, here's the new Counting Crows songs. The new Counting Crows song, it's not like a new album, big deal. And it just goes. Tell me that you. I mean, you would just jump out your car window. I'm sorry. You would just go, that is the wildest. But that's just not how any song starts now. It's just sort of just this. It's just a G chord in a beat. I don't know. Isn't that right?
Well, I'm trying to say, yes, exactly. They were going at great lengths to amuse themselves as musicians.
Right, exactly.
The joyfulness of that really is transparent in this record, especially like, Tomorrow Never Knows, and Lennon's doing these tape things. I mean, he's just enjoying the sounds that he's creating, and he's trying to find interesting ways to put them together, ways that people haven't heard before. And a lot of that is ego.
It is. That's right.
Wanting to separate yourself from But just the joy of it, and that's the thing that characterizes the Beatles throughout, as we were talking about earlier, about them laughing their way through outtakes of Your Bird Can Sing.
If you listen to those anthology things, there's tons of amusing moments on there. A song you've heard a million times, but the vocal track, they're just laughing or mess up the lyrics and cussing, and it's hilarious.
But I go back to that word joyful. It's just the joyfulness of
I think that's the whole secret of the Beatles, is just it was so fun, man, especially in those early middle years. Yeah. Just discovery it's infectious. I mean, when you start listening to it and you just start playing your own music, it was incredibly inspiring. And I think anybody can benefit. If you want to learn to play the piano, should you learn some Beethoven, some Mozart, kind of learn what made those guys tick? Yeah, you probably should. If you're going to play the trumpet, should you maybe know a little bit about Miles Davis? So I think today, if you're going to strum a guitar and sing, it's going to help you to know the Beatles. You can still love Hank Williams, of course. You can think that John Mayer's great, whatever. But you better go all the way back to the Beatles, man. And just learn how to sing. And you and I would, in our garage band, where a lot of guys were playing very simple, rudimentary type stuff, we were trying to play this stuff.
Yeah, we were.
And singing harmonies. And I was trying to play those McCartney bass lines. I played bass in the band. And so I was trying to play, boom, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Got a good reason. When that's hard to sing and play that bass line.
That's right. That's the first song you're learning.
And we would just we'd sit there and pound away at it. So when I got into my own music thing, I did feel light years ahead in some, even though I wasn't like reading music and stuff, I did feel like, man, I can sing, and I can sing harmony, and I can play bass, and I can I'd worked my way through those Beatles records, man. Right. I mean, if for nothing else,
And I'd like to say one last thing. Beatles, they loved they loved Buddy Holly. They loved the Texan.
Oh, yeah, no question.
And especially John,
and Ringo doing those country songs on.
Well, Buck Owens.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And I love Buck Owens. Yeah, but it's so rad that they took our influences that were right here in our backyard, made them theirs, and then that's
spit
the stuff
them back
that
out
we digested.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And it's just so cool, man. It's like.
It is, man.
And if you could put some Willie on top of that Beatles stuff, there you go.
It'd be amazing. It'd be amazing. I mean, and so in my whole life of just writing songs, playing music, and now recording a lot here in the studio, how many times do you just go back? Who was the first to do this type of recording, this sort of thing, with the backwards reverb of the, all that kind of, man, and 9 times out of 10, it just goes back to the Beatles. Yeah. When you really talk about pop music, we talk about Dylan a lot, and Steve Earle lyrics and stuff. Man, that kind of goes back to folk tradition. And Dylan goes back to folk tradition too, but a lot of guys, young guys who come in, who are kind of starting out, and they just know maybe some Cross Canadian Ragweed songs, you kind of go, man, that road leads to Dylan, man. Keep going down that road. Uh-huh. And in the pop rock world, all those roads lead to the Beatles. You may not know you like them or something, but you're telling me you like Wilco and stuff, man. They're not only a Beatles band; they're like a Beatles White Album band.
Exactly.
Like everything they make sounds like the White Album. Even though it's all different, they make a different record. But when their new stuff comes on, or their old stuff, their old stuff's a little more country. But the last like 3 or 4 records they've made, I just go, just sounds like the White Album. It sounds great. I love it. But the influence is there.
That's what I like to think. The Beatles spawned so many different genres of music.
Yeah,
so
that's
could,
right.
So you could point to this band and say, that's from Revolver. This band's from Rubber Soul. One of the reasons why I like Revolver is that it has a
REM,
little bit of
REM is a Revolver band. That stuff that we like, you know. So much of it, you know. Just you could see REM doing Things We Said Today or... You know, they're just a Beatles band, REM. Mm-hmm. That's why I always really liked them a lot. Well, man, that is Beatles talk with Wes Cunningham. Who else is more of an authority on the Beatles sitting around here than you and myself, I dare say?
Right.
Who've read every book, seen every movie, heard every record, digested every note. And who knows? Maybe we're all the better.
I still want to meet Paul. Can you make that happen? Can you
get
him in here?
Yeah, maybe I can. You think he's looking for a studio?
I don't know.
I got a fake Hofner bass hanging over there for him if he wants to make it in.
Love to meet
Paul McCartney.
You know
what I love about Paul is that she's always so unassuming, you know. We're going on, so we didn't know if anyone would come, you know. So I thought to myself, yeah. But then I just went out on stage. And
I got a few songs in it.
We couldn't believe it. People, they came from everywhere. They showed up. I'm like, don't act so surprised. Don't act so coy and so smug, you idiot.
What are you doing, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He goes, I didn't know what to play, you know. I've made lots of records over the play. I'm like, I know what you should play. But then I sat down and I just said, you know, just started out just when I find myself in time. I thought, oh, yeah, they wanted to hear
that's
that one.
One.
And then the crowd started to applaud, and they said, yeah, you know. So I'm just like, what do you mean? I'm always like, is he slowing that down,
you've got Ozzy, by the
that's
way.
That's right. is he playing this for a bunch of idiots, you know? I don't know. I think Paul really, you know, I remember sitting there in Texas Stadium watching McCartney play in like 91.
Yeah.
That huge thing, you know, the Texas Stadium. And he just kind of sat down at the thing, at the table, you know, and just, hey, Jude, don't make it bad. And just everyone around me starts hugging and weeping and take out their cigarette lighters, and they're swaying back and forth. And he's just, and I remember looking at him on the screen, and what struck me was just how distant he was from it.
What?
He's just playing this song he's played a million times. Huh. He's waving, all right, everybody now, now,
yeah,
uh-huh.
Now, 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 now.
And what,
just wrote.
What stuck with me about that show was, I go, man, he's the one guy on Earth, on this planet, who will not experience this song like everybody else in the whole world. It's just something he wrote. Yeah, people love it. Oh, thanks a lot. You know, okay, here's your autograph.
Yeah.
But he's the one guy he's not going to get to experience it like the rest of us. There's no way he will know what it means to all these people.
Wow.
Look at this. There's no way. You can't go tell him, hey, man, I really love Hey Jude, or I love Let It Be. Just, oh, yeah, thank you. I like that one, too. You know, it's fun to do. You know. There's no way, because he's too close to it.
Wow.
For any songwriter, it's like
that. That's a great point.
That's
someone
very
says that
powerful.
About your music, I mean, it's
well, you know, yeah. Yeah. You're just like, man, I like this song you do, or something. Like, great, you know, but I don't feel the same way about it that someone listening to it does. That's kind of the power of art, is it's more powerful to people who experience it, you know, than Michelangelo carving the Statue of David or Da Vinci painting the Mona Lisa, you know, it's like, I don't know, that old thing, I don't know. Yeah, I had fun doing it. What do you remember about it? I don't know, not much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what does it mean to everybody else, man, is something he is alone will not ever understand. So powerful thoughts there for you artists.
I got one thing to add to
that.
I do have a few songs that have come to me that I have felt...
came from a different place.
Came from a different
place.
Really? I reached up and I grabbed it out of the air, and there it was. It was a present for me. But it happens a couple of times.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And I have that feeling like I love. I mean, I just had that.
Yeah.
I feel like I heard it as if I didn't create it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You hear that story about
it? It's very rare. Yeah.
McCartney
scrambled eggs.
Writing yesterday, waking up in the middle of the night, scrambled eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my baby, how I love your legs.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Good Lord. It should be so easy for us.
Stupid.
Wes Cunningham has been here. Beatle authority. Singer, songwriter, musician who has lived all over the country, played all different kinds of music, met all different kinds of people, and continues to this day. Wife, children, father, musician, artist. Well, thanks for being here, man. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun on the podcast.
You've got to let me plug my new music, film.
What do you got? Where do we go for that?
Well, I'm not sure.
Do you know the website? Look for Wes Cunningham.
I've been writing like a madman this last year.
You got stuff on iTunes? Stuff's on iTunes,
not
right?
Not on iTunes.
Not on iTunes.
It was up there, and I took it off.
All right.
What you do is you go to Bandcamp.
Bandcamp.
Wes Cunningham, you know, .bandcamp.com or whatever.
Excellent.
Or you can go to the Facebook.
Right.
My artist page, Wes Cunningham. But
music you can hear, you know, everything.
You know what? The whole thing, I make music in my... I've got a little studio like you do.
Right.
And I make it in my... And I'm hardly selling it. I want people to hear it.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
Yeah. That's it.
So go hear it. Go and hear it's free. It. You don't have to pay anything. You can download it. Or you know, you can pay or not. It's one of those deals.
Yeah. Bandcamp, Wes Cunningham. Check it out, man. The music is out there. And he is as prolific a writer. He's always emailing me something, you know, something new. And always creating, always coming up with something new. Well, thanks for being here, Cunningham. My unplugged SG over there. It's going to play us out. PhilPritchard.com. PhilPritchard.com, RadioFreeTexas.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you next time on the P2 Podcast. Be good to each other out there.